welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 138, The Wheel of Dharma and Buddhism as Philosophy, Buddhist History 101.
This is what is kind of different about him, why Buddhism is a little bit different, why, although we think of it as a world religion, it is not really like other religions in some way. Because, for example, you know, the religion is usually founded by a prophet. Prophet goes into the wilderness, like Buddha did as a seeker, and then, you know, at one point or another sort of meets the burning bush, or, you know, has like a vision and comes back with the truth from God, you know, meets God. And Buddha, he didn't meet God. In fact, he decided there wasn't any God who was worth following what they had to say. He found out that the gods themselves were pretty much up a creek without a paddle, you know, in his view. They were worse off, actually, than the humans, the gods, because they were deluded by the pride of their power and the obsession with their pleasures, and they were deluded by their insulation from suffering. You know, and so they were very egotistical, you know, because they were gods, you know. I mean, it is sometimes said, you might have heard it said that Buddhism is atheistic, but that's not correct. The Buddhists always believed in gods, and the Buddha met many gods. He met the creator god of the Indian culture, whose name was Brahma. He actually met him and talked to him. But what Brahma told Buddha was, by the way, I'm not the creator, you know. I just showed up here one day at the time when there was no one else in the universe, and I was really puzzled, like, where did I come from? What is this? Who am I? And before I had time to really look into it, like, a whole other bunch of people showed up, and they saw me as already being here, and they said, da-da, you know? So then, I've been playing the big authority ever since, you know? But I don't even know where I came from. I have no idea. Could you tell me, Buddha? I'm really tired of pretending. This is a Buddhist story. Buddha lived to tell the tale of such a story in a culture where there were high priests and big temples making sacrifices to all these gods. And the Buddha met all these gods, and he found them to be, you know, jolly, friendly fellows. And with, you know, they unlike some of the Western gods, they were not bachelors, and therefore they weren't grumpy all the time. They were pretty jolly, most of the Indian gods, and they're very much into pleasure and having a good time. They had lovely goddesses all around. And, you know, but they didn't know the nature of reality. So Buddha didn't meet God and come up with a truth, is my point. What he founded was not a movement of belief. He did not tell people, you must believe what I say, you must believe what God says, you must worship God, and then God will save you. The opposite. He said, God can't save himself. You must disbelieve what the gods are purported to have said as reported to you by various priests and authorities. You should disbelieve that. It's usually a bunch of baloney that they do in order to get people to dominate people and get their allegiance, so that the people will make a lot of offerings and sacrifices to them. And then they have like one heck of a good barbecue with all of that sacrifice. So don't believe what they say. Believe what you discover yourself. Experiment. Discover the nature of reality for yourself. What he said he discovered, Buddha, I was a person like you. I was confused. I didn't know what was this and what was that. I found myself caught in suffering, and I didn't know where it came from or how to get rid of it. But now what I have discovered is, in fact, I have come to a direct, total, and reliable experience of the actual nature of the reality of myself and of every atom in the universe and of all things. I have had a direct understanding of the nature of everything. And luckily, having understood the nature of everything, the way I have understood it, it conduces to freedom, that reality. You know, he could have said, I understand everything, and it's going to stay a drag, you know. you can't get away from the suffering. You know, you better resign yourself to it. If you understand everything, it's a bad scene, and there's no way out of it. And we would have had the images of the Buddha, like, with a big frown on his face. But luckily, I mean, wouldn't you frown if you became, I have direct knowledge of the total nature of reality, of infinite past, present, future, infinite space, time, microverse, macroverse, the self, other, and it all sucks? Wouldn't you have a grim look on your face? Certainly. But instead, the man is smiling. Wow, you know, I understand absolutely everything, and that understanding itself provides me with a bliss far beyond any kind of bliss or happiness I even imagined in the past. And this is a guy who was a high roller, a king. He had power, pleasure of every type. And he said, nothing compares to the bliss of this total understanding of the nature of reality. Reality is in its essence bliss, isn't it? What that means? That's really a lucky thing, isn't it? I mean, unless, of course, he's totally demented, which he may be. But anyway, if we give a little credit of the doubt and say maybe he did understand something, what he understood was made him really happy. He felt really pleased. He said, everyone, well, actually, at first he was a little worried about it. He was very happy himself. The gods all came to him, actually, and they said, we would like to be so happy. Help us, tell us. Brahma, the creator god, came and brought this great wheel called the Wheel of Dharma, which is the wheel of teaching. And he gave him this wheel, this magic wheel, and he said, I've been keeping this wheel for 100,000 years since the time of the last Buddha on earth, the Buddha Kashyapa. And after he attained parinirvana, he entrusted this wheel to me in the Brahma heaven, and now I bring it to you. Turn the wheel. And then Buddha said, but I don't know if I should turn the wheel. He said, Samshi Tratel Usel Dumaji. Dudzi Tower Chuchi Kornye. Sula Tenjang Kor Mindube. Mima Naki Teldu Chikponye. He said, I have found a truth that is like elixir of immortality. It is profound, it is peaceful, it is trouble free, it is clear light, luminous, and it is completely uncreated, unfabricated. But if whoever I show it to, they may probably not understand it. Better that I remain silent and stay alone in bliss in the forest. He made this. This was his first statement in his death. And so Brahma came running down there and said, no, take this wheel and go turn it. Don't do that. And then it is said that he took Buddha, Brahma pointed out to Buddha this pond in one version of the story where there are all these lotuses growing. And he said, look at that pond. Now the sun rays are going on that pond, and some of the lotuses are blossoming, and some are red and blue and green, and they're reacting differently to those sun rays. And some of them remain closed, and some of them have already withered, and they can't respond anymore. But those sun rays do have some effect, beneficial effect on all of them. So the living beings are like that. Not everyone perhaps will understand the way you have understood, and so on, but many will understand. And so you really should shine the sun rays of your teaching, of what you have understood, for the benefit of beings. So, anyway, this is how the story goes. And so then he goes and he starts to teach living beings. Now, and the Buddhist movement begins from there. But you see, it's a different kind of a movement. What is it that made the Buddha achieve this freedom from suffering, as he says, as he calls it? It was not believing in something. And it was also no one else did it for him. It was through understanding something, and which he himself had to understand. And that thing that he understood was not like just accepting something or taking up a slogan or a formula. That understanding was a direct experiential understanding of the nature of reality. Actually, a scientific understanding. Aren't scientists, when scientists do experiments, you know, they detonate things, they put them in boxes, they do chemical things. They are experimenting with pieces of reality. And they're looking for the true way to describe, to understand what is actually taking place in that reaction or with that atom or with that disease or with that virus, whatever it is that they're doing. Isn't it? Isn't that what science means? To explore the nature of reality and come hopefully to a real understanding of that nature. Isn't it? Although they found that by doing that just through material methods and measurements, that it's like the more you measure, the more you're left unmeasured. They're having this problem nowadays. But basically, it is the approach of science to wish to gain understanding, even if modern science has come up with a presupposition that the prejudice really, that you can't really understand everything. They come up with that prejudice, that there's no such thing as omniscience, because they're thinking of all knowledge as quantity, and it's quantification. And obviously, when you're dealing with quantification and you have infinite field of things, then you'll never finish adding it all up. I mean, that's obvious. Infinity will never be counted, right? But if understanding the nature of things is not only quantitative, but if it has a qualitative element, if there's such a thing as a holistic, taking in the totality, or really an infinite type of understanding, if the understanding can match the infinity of the universe with the infinity of the understanding, then it may be possible to, in fact, come face to face with the reality of the universe, or such is what the Buddha said he did, anyway. So then what he's really foisting upon people, if he says, this is the way I got free, this is the way you can get free, the poor guy is in the position of a much harder job than just running around saying, I have the truth, believe it, and shut up. Go to church, or go to the ritual, or go to the temple, or whatever. That's sort of easy, relatively speaking. You know? I mean, you know, maybe they crucify you, and the old religion doesn't like the new one, whatever. But, you know, it's sort of simple, you know. Yes, I'll follow you or not. Or yes, I believe or I don't, you know. It's not so difficult. I mean, it may be difficult for individuals to do so, but it isn't a difficult job for the person. They just run along, and they just say, this is it. And they keep saying the same thing over and over, till either everybody believes them or somebody wastes them, one or the other. In the case of the Buddha's task, when he sees living beings as independent in a way, and therefore as causing their own suffering, each one responsible for it, and capable of causing their own freedom and liberation through their own understanding, what is the one way he can help beings in that sort of situation? The only thing you can do is try to educate them. Do you follow me? Educating in the real sense, you can't indoctrinate them, and you can't sort of magically, like, you know, put some chemical in their body or send a ray into their mind or somehow become their understanding, because it's their understanding. If your understanding is already free. But for them to become free, they have to have an understanding of the nature of reality themselves. And you can't help another to understand something without, except by trying to educate them. Right? How do we produce? Actually, in Indian logic, in Buddhist logic, there's a term, inference, you know? And, you know, like making a reasoning and coming to understand something, right? Like, for example, I came into this room through that door when I opened that piece of glass, that slab of glass. I was able to walk through that door. Ergo, when I want to leave the room, it's best for me to go and pull back the slab of glass and walk out that door. So I can understand that's how I get out of the room. So when I go, I'm not going to try to walk through the wall or jump out the window or climb up to the ceiling. That's an inference, and that's a valid understanding, and that helps me get out of the room, right? Now, if one of you has had a bout of amnesia and doesn't know how you got in here, then I can't sort of tell you, you know, I mean, you would be wise not to follow my suggestion if I say, believe that you can go out through that brick wall and run at it. All your reason says that the bricks look solid, but don't believe me and go through the brick wall. Then that would be foolish of you. That would be against your understanding, and you shouldn't follow me, see. But then if I say to you, well, now, have you ever been in another room where you came in by the door? And you might remember, oh, yeah, I did. Well, I've forgotten today, but yes, I did. Okay, well, see, that looks like a door. Here, I pull it open and open, wave my hand through it. Now, if you, by these experiments and these examples and these, like, similar cases, you can make an inference, you can develop the understanding that if you walk out there and go through, you can get through the door, even though you can't remember that you did. Okay, it's a very simple thing, but this is how we do live, don't we? We have inferences, we accept reliable testimony from others. This helps us produce an understanding of what we should do, right? Someone says, this is a delicious kind of asparagus. Go and buy it. I ate it. It's good. They never wouldn't deceive us. They're not profiting by our buying it. Our suspicions can be cool, and we go and buy the asparagus. We have a delicious meal. That's how we live. So therefore, education is the same. Oh, if you look critically at the nature of your mind, then you follow such a method, if you don't come to that understanding, and you try and do all the methods that you're taught to do, then forget it, I'm probably wrong. Don't believe it. The point is, this is an experimental method. You're being suggested, you try it, if it works for you, you do it. So this is different, isn't it, than founding a religion as we normally understand it? Isn't that quite different? It doesn't give you the easy comfort of snap, here you go, you know. Just believe this, or belong to that, or join this group, or follow this authority. It's the opposite. This guy, now, once Buddha attained Buddhahood, he apparently was quite a handful. It is said that nobody dared even draw a picture of him for like 200 years or something. He was like a kind of seething energy field or something like that. People would meet him and they would just flip out, apparently. This energy would sort of, they would feel energized by it in such a way, and they were almost confused, and he looked all different ways with different people, and he was like a real presence, apparently. So he's someone who easily could have, and his skin was all gold, you know. Light rays were constantly shooting out of this little tuft of white hair, this third eyebrow that he had. It came into its own, finally, and light rays used to come shooting. No, it's like a transistor thing. It would sit there and suddenly, like a little light, but light rays would beam out all over the place, you know. He would perform all kinds of miracles, even in the most ordinary form of so-called humanistic form of Buddhism. He's constantly performing all these miracles. You know, someone comes up and says, "Oh, you're such a turkey, get out of my face." His father was very mad with him when he came to his father, back to his hometown, because he was begging lunch, because he lived like that. He begged his food, even though he was a Buddha. And the father was very nice. "You're a royal prince of the Shakya. You come here like a beggar. You're embarrassing me." And he sent out the best caterers in the kingdom, you know. The Buddha refused all the catered food, gave it to the poor, and went and took a simple thing for the poor household, you know. And the father was really upset. So he came up and was upbraiding his son. And then the Buddha said, "Look, Dad, you think I'm your son, but get a load of this." And he like multiplied himself in like 500 bodies. And then from the upper part of the bodies, all these flames came broiling out. And the lower part like flooded the whole town, you know. So he turned into fire and water and zoomed around. He gave him like a real skyrocket like fireworks show, complete with rain showers and scented mists and all this. So then he said, "So, you know, something different has happened, Dad. I know you think I'm just, but I'm a little different now." So then, "Oh, yeah, so then, okay, you can beg if you want, you know. I'm not embarrassed about you anymore," said the father, you know. So, and actually the father became arhat. The father came to his own understanding very quickly, actually, and became free and very blissful and happy, what they call an arhat, you know, a liberated saint, very quickly, quite quickly. So anyway, the poor Buddha, what he had to do was, it was his same job was like Socrates' job. You know, Socrates didn't just go and tell everybody rush over and have a sacrifice at Delphi or something. Socrates came and said, "What did you say? You think you know that? Well, how do you know it? What is it?" You know, dialogue, you know, like examining, getting the person to be critical about their own stupid opinions and their own dogmatic received prejudices and their own confusions, and getting them to investigate their mind in a slow and steady interactive teaching dialoguing process, right? That's what the great Socrates did. And Buddha had to do the same thing because it was the only way of the other person achieving the freedom that the Buddha was compelled to help the other person to achieve, because he felt so happy and free, and he couldn't bear for the others to feel unhappy when they didn't need to. So he's forced to dialogue with them. That's how you're the only way to do it. Because only there, some change that they independently initiate in their own mind can make them free, you see. You can't make another free. We know that, right? It's impossible. You can only provide the conditions. You can only give the reasons. You can only give the inspiration. But they have to come themselves to that understanding, right? So the Buddhist tradition, the Buddhist movement, therefore, fundamentally, is an educational movement on this planet. It is very interesting that it starts at the same time as the Socratic educational movement, the Platonic Academy. If you go up to Columbia University, my home institution, and you look at the library, well, as one of my students says, it looks to you like a Greek restaurant, more or less. Well, that means that carved up on the library are all these Greek men's names. You know, Sophocles, Plato, you know, Democritus, and all these Greek names, which are all contemporaries, more or less, of the Buddha, which is really interesting, I think, isn't it? Supposedly a completely disconnected culture and a different civilization, blah, blah, blah. But yet, the very same founders of what ends up as like the educational tradition of Columbia University were contemporary with the founders of the educational tradition that taught all of Asia, actually, and all of India for thousands of years. And Confucius also, that person who really started what still is the one decent Chinese educational system, and don't think that Mao's was decent. You know, the one decent one, which will have to be brought back for them to again recover their education.
and their own culture and civilization, which we hope they will in the next few generations. Confucius was the founder of that. That's again a contemporary of the Buddha. Confucius was almost exact contemporary of the Buddha. He died 2 years after the Buddha. He was born a couple of years after the Buddha. So he unleashed this educational tradition. Now, this of course then gets into the issue of Indian. So there's this complicated education. You know, education requires time. You have to have learning. You have to like slowly cultivate a new understanding. You know, one thing you've heard a lot about in Buddhism is that Buddhism, I bet a lot of you think there's such a thing as sudden enlightenment, kind of the super eureka experience, right? This is popularized. People, when they compete with each other to be more popular Buddhist teachers, to get Buddhist bigger classes, to have bigger Dharma centers, to get more adherents, this and that, they go out and they say, I have a faster enlightenment than the next guy. You know, you can get mine in the afternoon seminar. You don't even need the whole weekend. Just come and, you know, you get this one and that blessing and this thing and the other, and then you're enlightened. Sudden enlightenment. Everyone like advertises that. It's actually totally false. Totally misleading. That doesn't mean that when the Buddha did attain his enlightenment under that morning on the Bo tree, there were some marvelous eureka experiences that he had. He had a whole night long full of them. But he, and even in his life, had been already meditating uninterruptedly for 6 years. And he, before that, had been studying all sorts of things that he was ready to be a Buddha. He had actually been working on it for many, many lives. So, a process of it. Now, when you educate yourself, when you go to philosophy class, and you try to discover and understand the categorical imperative, and then you read all of Kant, and that's a terrible headache. And then you read this and that. Then you go, okay, categorical imperative. It is my duty to do what, you know, I would will everyone else to do in a similar circumstance, so that anything I do would be universally applicable. You know, categorical imperative, like a sort of a universal ethical law or something like that. Abstraction. Then you say, okay, I got it. I got to understand it. It's like, well, something that's valid should be valid universally. And you have a kind of eureka experience. After a long time of study, you finally, you get what he's getting at. You see. And so you have changes that are swift. You have changes that are swift. But that doesn't mean that you haven't worked up and developed that swift change. And then the process of education, there are many swift changes. You know, you have a eureka experience last night, and then the next day you're not quite sure what it was. And then you sort of go back, and then you remember, oh, right. And then you have, oh, but you see another aspect to it. You dialogue with somebody and you see even more deeply. You see that you only had part of it, in fact, and there's even more, and that there's more. And reality is so marvelous because there's always endlessly more to discover. So an education process, you don't expect to go and become, you know, chemistry 101, 103, 205, 604, advanced chemistry, 4 years of studies. You don't expect to go to the first class and pop, you know, then you know it. You wouldn't respect such a knowledge. Someone who came to you with a diploma saying they'd been at the Columbia University for 5 minutes, and the chemistry professor gave them a pill, and the philosophy professor had them eat a book, and you'd throw them out, because you don't expect them to have really changed anything about their judgment and understanding with such a gimmick. So why should this education be any different? Especially, this education is educating the total mind of the being to totally transform their perception of reality, of themselves and of everything, and for have that perception, the transformation of that perception transformed the whole quality of their experience and their whole internal feeling and all of their external relations. You wouldn't expect that just as a pop, you know. And in fact, there are stories of people who had radical shifts at different times in their lives, but always as a culmination of a long process of development, and then afterwards they went on with more radical shifts. The great Zen master Hakuin, in the name of Zen, there have been a lot of baloney about sudden enlightenment. The great Zen master Hakuin, when they asked him at one time, like, how many enlightenments did you have? How many satoris? He said, oh, well, the first 30 years I kept a kind of count, and now I've forgotten. I lost count. Meaning that it was actually a long, incredible process, you know, that was continuing in some way. So then Buddha discovered that. So then he had the problem, how, once you want to have a deliver a kind of education, and particularly if you feel this education is something that benefited you so much and that will really benefit other people, then you have to sort of begin to think about the delivery systems of that education. How are you going to deliver it to all these people? Now, luckily, the Buddha was educated as a general. In those days, to be trained to be a king meant you were trained to be a general. The Buddha did not go to the liberal arts college. The Buddha went to West Point, and he learned how to manage infantry and cavalry and elephant troops and archery, and he was a wrestler, and he was knew martial arts himself, and he there are a lot of stories about it. He was one of these very frustrating students who knew 10 times more than the teacher in about 5 seconds. So he was pretty sudden on all of his things. But anyway, he was trained to think about, he was prepared to manage communities. He knew the ancient sociology of what is called the Arthashastra in ancient India. They're very sophisticated. They wrote, they had books dating from 700, 400 before the Common Era that are like, you know, quadruple Machiavelli. I mean, 100 times more sophisticated than Machiavelli. Really, really sophisticated. I mean, they even have like instructions on how to plant deep moles in your military academy. Really. In that book, the Arthashastra, they teach kings, you know, when you have your military academy and all the young cadets go to the academy, then you have to get someone who is the son of someone who is completely indebted to you and totally loyal. And that person goes to that academy and befriends a certain class. And then after they graduate and they're given their posts, and they're captains or colonels or generals, then that one is supposed to stir up an incitement to rebellion and to, you know, to treason on the part of the most sort of energetic and the most independent-minded and ambitious of his colleagues. And then he stimulates them to rebel against you. But since he's your mole, who then entraps them that way, you know about the rebellion. Before it comes, you catch all of them. Do you execute them? No. You send them out to the provinces to govern the most difficult places in the province of your kingdom because they're the most ambitious and the most... But you keep them away from you, but you employ them, you don't kill them. I mean, this is sophisticated political science. It's not spiritual at all. India was an incredibly sophisticated country, is what I'm trying to communicate. So the Buddha knew about that stuff very well. He was not some naive, like, spiritual hippie, hey, I'm enlightened. He knew about how you manage communities. So therefore, he now had the need to form a new community. He realized that within the, you know, people in the army, people in here and there, they were not going to have time. Women in the household, subjected to all that they were subjected to at that time, they would not have time to open up this knowledge, to investigate the nature of themselves and the universe, to receive this training and develop this meditation and do this education and really come to be free and enlightened. There was no way. He had to create a special institution to do that. There was no such thing as a Harvard or Columbia or New School or whatever it is. There was no such thing. There were little family schools, trade schools everywhere. He had gone to a trade school in the palace school for the new princes, for the new king, you know. The Brahmin priests had a trade school for their children to become the new priests. The merchants had trade schools. The peasants had, everyone had a trade school. You did what your father did. I mean, that's all there was. There was no such thing as liberal education. So how to found such a thing? Well, you have to go to the donors. You have to go to the merchants. You have to go to the kings. How are you going to get an endowment from these kings and these merchants? They don't give this stuff easily. Ask any college president today. The guy's like sitting there with 11 aspirins before 6 o'clock in the morning. It's hard to get this kind of support, especially for such a knowledge. What are you going to tell them? Oh, fund my school, and then all the men who otherwise would be in your factories and in your army are going to go there, shave their head, put on a yellow dress, and come out and say, I'm enlightened. Sorry, Your Majesty, I can't work today. All the women are going to leave their household and they're going to say, sorry, I don't want to have 11 children this week. I don't want to wash all the dishes. I don't want to prepare all the food. I don't want to do this lifelong. I want to go over and I'm going to meditate and attain enlightenment. I don't even want to like comb my hair all the time. I'm going to shave it off. Not all this constant like hair thing. I'm not even going to put on my face. I'm going to drop my face and attain enlightenment. You go to the king and say that? You fund this thing and then everybody's going to tell you, no, Your Majesty, I have no time for everything? That's not an easy sell. Socrates, he went to talk to two guys in the gym about some philosophy and they got so upset that that was going to ruin their army against the Spartans that they killed him. Those kings in those days were not giving up their troops and the patriarchs were not giving up the women who did all the work, who bore the children, who cleaned everything, who like complete slaves in those days. Giving all of them up, oh, you want to attain enlightenment? Sure, honey. Off you go. I'll cook supper tonight and for the next 50 years I'll cook supper. We'll have no children to go and do the work in the field and do the make the shoes, whatever. Sure, honey, you go get enlightened. How is that going to happen easily? Very strange how it happened. So Buddha tried to make it as painless as possible. He said, look, if you know the nature of reality, You don't even need a house. You don't need clothes. You don't need, well, we'd use clothes because it's like people don't like, you know, a bunch of naked yogis. There were some movements around him who were naked, but he thought that was a little funky. And he said, we'll have a robe, you know, we'll wear like a, you know, a toga. But all we need is one toga. We need one bowl. There's plenty of food. India is was the richest country agriculturally in the world by far at that time. There's food that rots every season. They were short on refrigerators. He said, we'll beg some food, small amount. We won't have children. We'll be celibate. We won't accumulate any property, and we'll live here and there. And the great thing is, anybody who feeds us, we give them a lecture. And, you know, it's nice to get a lecture. You know, you're out there pounding rice all day. Somebody comes up and says, well, look, you know, think about it. Who are you really? Why are you pounding that rice? Well, I mean, when you're pounding it, why is your mind feeling unhappy? About what, you know? You're a human being. You know what it means to be a human being? What are you doing? So, you know, lectures can be liberating, can make you feel cheered you up, you know. So all you have to do is give a couple of some old crust of bread to this monk or none, and you got a lecture, you know. So that's a kind of service, you know. So Buddha went to the kings, and he said, let us be like this. Give us this, like, license to do this. You already have wanderers outside of town. India already has enough of a surplus that there's, like, these seekers, like I was one of them, who are men of upper classes. And we'll just have a few extra, he said. Maybe a few more will come once we have an established order and there's sort of more of a systematic education. But, you know, you have men, people to spare, Your Majesty. It's not a problem, you know. Even you might like it, Your Majesty. And yeah, the Majesty liked it. They were studying. They became enlightened. In fact, the kings did. So they said, sure, here you can have my park. I have like six extra parks. You take that one. And you and the monks go live in that park. And anytime you come to town, you can stay in that park. And then I'll also offer you the food, and you give me a lecture. No problem. So he founded the Sangha. It's called the monastic order. And his stepmother and his ex-wife came and demanded that he found a female sangha, which he somewhat resisted, it has to be said. And people, some feminist scholars say that he had become enlightened, but he hadn't shaken his male chauvinism. But I don't think that's quite correct, personally. Because by definition, it isn't correct. I mean, as far as the tradition goes, it might be correct. Maybe it's sort of the tradition doesn't really know. Who knows? Maybe he was a chauvinist. But I would rather see it as his knowledge of the society. He just simply felt that when women started getting liberated, that the society would develop an inability to digest this new movement. When women became liberated too many, too fast, and too large a number, it would be impossible to digest it. And that proved to be true, actually. The women's order was much less long-lived than the men's, because not because they were any less enlightened. They were more enlightened, undoubtedly. But there were too many of them who wanted to do it, because their life was harder, because they were more subjected to more servitude. They had a harder time. So naturally, given the idea of liberation on either both physical as well as spiritual level, women chose it more. This may be hard to understand from a modern point of view. As I often tell students who are kind of puzzled by that idea, why would so many women want to become Buddhist nuns? They're sort of wondering, and I always tell them, and many laugh, I think it's true, in Western Protestant sort of dominated society, everyone's image of a nun is Audrey Hepburn locked up in her cell with the nasty Mother Superior glowering at her, Gregory Peck waiting by the bus station down there, looking with his two tickets, looking worried, and then she's tying her sheets together, you know, out the window, you know, and will she escape is all we can think, you know. And of course she does, luckily. Rips off that habit, puts on some makeup and eye gloss, and off they go. So we naturally think of the monastic life as an imprisonment, as a punishment, as something awful. But in ancient India, or in any peasant society even today, if you actually reflect on the lot of women, I mean, men have a horrible time too in those societies. Naturally, in any society where the women have a horrible time, you know the men are going to be having a horrible time. They'll just be maybe better fed, or they'll look more idle, but they'll be miserable. That the miserable women will see to that. And they can't help it because they're not happy, so, you know, they have headaches all the time. So the men... So the point is that the women, you know, in those societies, at 12 you have your first child. You know, and then you continue to have them all the time until you break down, more or less. And you do all the work, and you do all the cooking, and you're like kept out and you eat in the kitchen. And I mean, it's really difficult. And, you know, the idea of what? Be a nun? And no cooking? And no childbirth? No nasty husband? No nasty mother-in-law? No nasty father? No nasty son? I'm just the property of each one of the generations of the males. To get away from that, here I come, Buddha, you know, to give up a few little, like, paltry, you know, sexual experiences, mostly with terrible men who are lousy lovers anyway because they're so uptight. And anyway, they're usually 50 years older than me. I'm married at 13 to some, like, horrible old guy who buys me from my parents. I mean, there's no pleasure to be left. It's just a sheer escape. But the official religion was known as Vedism. We could call today, some people would say Hinduism, but that would be inaccurate. Because what we now think of as Hinduism is in fact a kind of synthesis between the old religion that existed at that time and much of the innovations brought in by Buddhism and Jainism and the movements that occurred during the Buddha's time and afterwards. But what existed at that time was something called Vedism, or Brahmanism, you can call it. And they had a pantheon of gods, which are actually related to the Greek gods, like Zeus and so forth. They did, it centered on a sacrificial ritual. It was very elitist, only members of the upper class, the priests, the warriors, and the higher kinds of merchants were admitted to that ceremony. The majority of the population were, you know, workers and were not admitted to it. And it was a very life-affirming kind of, this worldly sort of religion, where if you offered these sacrifices, the gods blessed you and kept you free of sickness and gave you victory in battle or progeny or wealth or whatever it is that you wanted, depending on your station in life. And, you know, it was pretty jolly type of religion. There was no thought in that religion of release or liberation. The world was conceived as a sort of one kind of a mechanism in which you always would exist. And you could just exist in a happy way. You could become an ancestor in heaven or go to a happy hunting ground, or you could even become a god, or you would dissolve back into the earth if you lived a bad life and didn't do sacrifices and the gods were displeased with you. But there was no, you know, you either had a good, you could rise in society, in life after life in society, or fall down, but there was no question of getting away from it type. You know, and it taught duty. Religion meant duty and obedience to law, obedience to the authority structure, and it was a kind of religion like that. That was the major religion. And so the Buddha, in not being the king according to the rule of his father, obeying his father and being the king, and not to being a general and a warrior and a conqueror and so forth according to his class, and not to be staying with his family according to his household duty, etc., not offering sacrifices to the Brahmins and the gods, was completely making a terribly, really extreme rupture with that religion. And he was going against what all the priests were saying. And the father had many priests talk to him and say, look, you can't do this. The Veda says this. The sacred scripture says that. You're breaking, you're disobeying your father. You're going against the will of the gods. You're going to have misfortune. You're going to cause misfortune to the world, etc., etc. In fact, it is most likely that in the Bhagavad Gita, the famous text of Hinduism, in case some of you know that, Arjuna, remember, at the beginning, he doesn't want to fight the battle, remember? He doesn't want to fight with his kinsmen and his former friends and teachers, and he wants to get out of his duty as a warrior, and then God tells him he better do it, remember? But Arjuna's desire to drop out in that way is actually what the Buddha did, you see. And therefore the Gita represents a kind of a brahminical attempt to reabsorb that desire to sort of break out of the authority structure. And that's really, then that's when it becomes Hinduism, because it's reacting against, it's absorbing elements of and reacting against the Buddhist revolt, basically, which is what the Buddha led. It was this kind of anti-religious revolt. I don't say anti-spiritual, because he felt he discovered the spiritual purpose of human life, which is happiness on every level, permanent. But it was anti-religious, definitely. Now, it is also possible at that time, although this is undocumented, that the majority of the population, the very lower classes, the many lower classes, many of whom were residual from an earlier layer of Indian civilization that predated the Vedic people, who sort of came in about 1,000 years before Buddha's time, gradually in long migrations, you know, and sort of dominated the local people, conquered and dominated. And it is possible that there were folk religious levels, you know, goddesses, especially more female goddesses. The Vedic religion, there, all the goddesses were male, more or less. There was almost no female goddess, 2 or 3 female goddesses, and hundreds of male gods. But there was a popular, more earthy type of religion beneath that, and that these people were very dissatisfied with the Vedic elite, and they were kind of in a ferment state. And therefore, another reason that is speculated for the success of Buddhism is that the growing power of this disaffected majority associated itself with this new religious outlet and this new spiritual path of Buddhism, because it was open to the lowest classes, the non-Brahminical, the non-Vedic classes. Or anyone could join the Buddhist monastery, and all their old status, their mundane status, was completely dissolved upon entering the monastic community, and they became equal, although the ones who were there longer had a little bit of seniority, that's all. Okay? Does that answer your question? Okay. So it's wrongly, now, you will hear that Buddhism was a reform of Hinduism, but it goes way beyond that. It really was a revolt against Hinduism. I mean, when I read, the more I read, you know, and as I teach the subject, I reread these literature every year, but now for 30 years, and, you know, different things, of course, but I keep rereading, and it amazes me more and more how the Buddha got away with it. I mean, that thing I said about God, I mean, you'd be screwed, you'd be lynched, you'd be burned at the stake for such a joke, you know. He has like this, he jokes the Brahmins, you know. He teases them. He's completely irreverent, in fact, you know. He's rude to them here and there. They get them to think, you know. He's just like Socrates. He's more than a gadfly. He's like a great bumblebee, you know. But still, somehow he gets away with it all. In all versions, of course, in Mahayana Buddhism, in Universal Vehicle Buddhism, there's millions of them all over the place, even now, at all times, in every atom and everywhere. You know, there's so many Buddhas. It's just, they're like, Buddhas are like, you know, swarms of fireflies or something zipping around, you know. But like stars in the sky or something. But even in the monastic Buddhism, which was more conservative in that role, there were sometimes seven previous Buddhas on this planet. And sometimes three, there were different versions. And there were going to be 900 and so more in the history of this planet. And other planets, which they all believed in, even the conservative Buddhists, all had Buddhas. I mean, sort of Buddhas were part of nature. You see, in that worldview, Buddha is not a person. It's like a biological form. It's like the ultimate biological form. It's sort of the destiny form that life is tending toward, that life aspires to. Although life can also deviate and go back, you know, and regress away from. But in other words, it's a sort of the living state of perfect happiness. It's what a Buddha is. And therefore, any place where there is life, there are Buddhas. Because beings have had infinite time to achieve their ideals, and some have managed, you see, in the way the Buddhists view it. It really is a biological thing, you see. A Buddha is also, this is another thing, a Buddha, we think of enlightenment when we hear it, we think of Voltaire and the 18th century enlightenment, maybe Jefferson, then we think of Buddha and some mystic somewhere, and we think of people who are just people and who had a kind of change of mind, you know, they had a brilliant idea or something. But enlightenment is not only this change, it's such a total change of understanding that it involves changing the body and the brain and everything. And a being becomes really totally different. And of course, this is unpacked to a greater degree of detail as the tradition elaborates. Exactly, just, you know, the more and more people try to grasp what could this amazing butterfly, sort of which has been the end of the evolution of the cocoon of all of biology, what is this fantastic butterfly? And they have a lot of speculation about it. So there's endless forms. Every one of us will become a Buddha, in fact, in the Mahayana sense. The more conservative one, they sort of don't emphasize that, but everyone can become liberated, and they sort of don't necessarily insist that you go on from being liberated to become a Buddha, to develop the body of Buddha, the ability to teach a Buddha. You just personally become liberated. That's all they emphasize, because they don't want to, like, overstress a person who feels that's too grandiose a kind of goal. They don't want to make them feel hopeless and despaired. On the other hand, there's a very important point, and that is that the Buddhists make, in all of the schools, even the most sort of magical types of giving the most magical vision of Buddha, they insist that even though Buddha was almost like a god, even something beyond the gods, and even in the monastic Buddhism, they call him the teacher of the gods and the humans. That's one of his, Deva Manushyanam Shastra, that's one of his important names, his teacher of humans and the gods. But they make a big point about the fact that he attained his Buddhahood in the human life form, even though he had almost divine existences previously, because the human life form is considered the most advantageous life form within which to achieve enlightenment, it is considered. And also is considered very important because if people didn't feel that the Buddha as a human came to the total and full understanding of himself and his environment, they would then feel, well, I can't understand everything. You'd have to be like a god or some sort of superhuman being to do that, and I'm just a human. So the human can't understand this, you see. So the Buddha purposely, even those that show the Buddha as able to choose his, like an artist, to be able to create his own life, like almost like a filmmaker, not Italian one, much better. But anyway, filmmaker, choose his own life, you know, they say that he chose specially to become a human and to attain enlightenment from the human form because the main people who could benefit by that example were the human beings. And the reason the human, there's many reasons why the human being is the most advantageous, but it's because the human being has a godlike intelligence, but it has an animal-like embodiment that is vulnerable to suffering, unlike a god, and has a fairly short lifespan, so death and decay is sort of immediate to a human's experience, fairly quickly, where they don't live billions of years like gods do. And so they get to where they want to use that godlike intelligence to try to understand their situation, and that intelligence is adequate to do so. And then the incentive is there because of the vulnerability and the suffering of the human life. So therefore, it's really ideal from the Buddhist point of view. And, you can be that. In other words, the message of the Buddha having been human is that you human can be a Buddha. You can understand everything, that means. And notions that you have of, I couldn't understand that, are themselves to be questioned. Because your brain is actually, your mind is adequate to understanding everything that you need to understand. That's the point.
Benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. For a complete listing of all upcoming Robert Thurman events, please visit bobthurman.com. And for upcoming events in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City.